This training is an introduction to the associated online guidance document noted on this slide, Integrated DNAPL Site Characterization and Tools Selection. This guidance document was produced by ITRC in 2015. Although we will be able to share a lot of information with you today, we certainly will not be able to share all the tools and resources available in this guidance document. So we strongly encourage you to take a look at it if you haven't already done so. We hope it will serve as a resource for you as you are working on your environmental sites. Today's training is sponsored by the Interstate Technology and Regulatory Council, or the ITRC, and is hosted by the U.S. EPA Cleanup Information Network, or CLUIN. Today's training is scheduled for about 2 hours and 15 minutes. We are also recording this event to make it available on demand for those who are not able to make it today. Trainers will be in control of the slides as we move through today's training session. If you'd like to control your own slides, you are able to download the slides from the initial training page you were directed to today. You can also access the slides by going to the related link section, clicking on the CLUIN training page, and then clicking Browse To. We want to hear from everybody today, both your questions and your feedback. You'll have an opportunity about halfway through for a question and answer break, as well as at the end. But at any time today, you can feel free to ask your question in the Q&A pod in the lower right-hand corner of your screen. We will try to answer as many of those questions as we can verbally during the question and answer break. If we have too many questions to answer out loud, we will ask our trainers to respond directly back to that person in writing through our Adobe Connect website. For those of you on the phone line, if you would like to ask a question out loud, we will also give you an opportunity to ask your questions during the Q&A break. And we will remind you at that time that it is #6 to unmute your phone line. There is also an online feedback form for you to complete to let us know how the training went today. By completing this feedback form, you will be eligible to receive your certificate of completion to support your documentation of continuing education. At the end of the feedback form, you will be able to certify that you participated today. Once you do that, a certificate will be issued to you. The Interstate Technology and Regulatory Council is a program of the Environmental Council of States. We are a state-led organization composed of over 1,000 members from state agencies, federal government, the private sector, academia, and community stakeholders. Our members participate in technical teams which produce tools, resources, and training courses, such as the one you are participating on today. If you'd like to be a part of ITRC, please visit the ITRC website or feel free to contact us directly. On our website, you can register for teams and learn more about how you can be an active member. The full ITRC disclaimer is available on the ITRC website as well. If you do plan to use ITRC materials, we ask that you review that policy in detail and be sure to credit ITRC. ITRC is partially funded by the U.S. government. ITRC nor the U.S. government warranties of material or endorse any specific products. On slide 5, I appreciate the opportunity to introduce our expert trainers. All of them have been active members of ITRC's Integrated DNAPL Site Characterization and Tools Selection Team over the years. Not only do they serve as volunteer trainers for ITRC, they have dedicated many hours to develop this guidance document. A special thank you to all of them for participating today. Our trainers today are Alec Noggle, California Water Board, Tamsin Macbeth, CDM Smith, Trevor King, AECOM, Jeremy Musson, Pinion Environmental, and Ryan Wymore, CDM Smith. If you'd like to read more about their expertise, you can access their bios at the link at the bottom of the page. You can also access it in the related links section by clicking on CLUIN training page and then clicking Browse To. At the bottom of that training page, you can access their bios as well. So with that, let's move on to the next slide, and I'm going to pass it off to Alec.
All right. Thank you, Nicole. So for the next few slides, I'm going to give you an overview of what we're calling the DNAPL problem. I'm also going to mention some solutions that ITRC has put forth in two recent guidance documents that improve the ways, or can help improve the ways that DNAPL sites are characterized and remediated. So here's the problem. Restoring DNAPL sites to what amounts to low part per billion drinking water standards has proven to be exceptionally challenging, and I think we would all agree with that. And while we have some success stories, they are relatively few compared to the ones that aren't succeeding, and the time frames and the costs that amount to achieve the standards present a significant barrier. And the reasons for this we've compiled here, first, we think the main reason is probably an incomplete understanding of DNAPL sites, and that's a focus of this training, and that includes DNAPL behavior and hydrogeologic complexities that exist. The second reason is probably subsurface heterogeneity, and that's just another way of saying that there's highly variable permeabilities and other factors, and that they're hard to fully characterize, but they end up controlling the contaminant distribution and the contaminant response to remediation. And then thirdly, there are some cases where we just have unrealistic remedial objectives, such as we don't recognize the mismatch between how effective a remedial technology might be for a given site and its characteristics. And then the last one is the mismatch between the remedy and the site complexities. So I guess the last two, three, and four bullets are somewhat similar. Okay, moving to question seven, we have a quick poll here. And so we'd like you to respond to this. For sites that you have worked on or are working on, when did cleanup activities begin? If you could go ahead and select this, we think that we're probably going to see some pretty long time frames here, because that's been our experience. So, we're seeing, again, a lot of sites. The top three categories seem to be, potentially 30 years. And that's pretty much what we had thought, is that a lot of these sites have been worked on for a long period of time. Remedies weren't necessarily aligned correctly with the site conditions. We didn't have the high-resolution techniques. We didn't have the knowledge of the ability to target remedies. So a lot of these sites have been hanging on for a long time. Okay, let's move on to slide eight. So digging a little deeper, our ITRC team realized that the standard concepts for approaching DNAPL sites were outdated. And for example, when the cleanup industry was established in the 1970s and 1980s, most practitioners believed that contaminant transport was mainly controlled by groundwater flow. Idealized plume behavior was assumed based on simple advection dispersion equations, which tended to discount the effects of heterogeneity on the contaminant partitioning and the matrix diffusion, and the effects of contaminant behavior on dissolution and sorption. So it's no wonder that we have many DNAPL sites with limited remedial successes at this stage. Moving to slide nine. Oh, there we are. Moving on to slide nine. ITRC's integrated dense non-aqueous phase liquid site strategy, also known as IDSS, from 2012, it's a technical and regulatory guidance document, and this is one of the two that I mentioned earlier that can assist site managers in developing this integrated remedial strategy. The main points are that the strategy is comprehensive. It's for the entire cleanup life cycle. The IDSS has within it five key topics of the integrated strategy that comprise the strategy. And the first is, obviously, quite simply, a conceptual site model. We want the CSM that is based on a reliable characterization and an understanding of subsurface conditions that are controlling the contaminant transport, the contaminant reactivity, and the distribution. Second are remedial objectives and performance metrics that are clear, concise, and measurable. Third are treatment technologies that are applied to optimize performance and take advantage of these potential synergistic effects. Fourth, monitoring based on interim and final cleanup objectives and the selected treatment technology and approach, and remedial performance goals. So monitoring, considering all of those things. And then last, reevaluating the site strategy. This is a key step, repeatedly and even modifying the approach when necessary, when objectives are not being met, or when alternative methods offer similar or better outcomes at a lower cost. So it's the built-in feedback loop. Moving to slide 10. So after developing the integrated site remedial strategy guidance, we immediately realized that the updated DNAPL site characterization guidance that ITRC had going back to the early 2000s was needed to address outdated assumptions. And this is the subject of today's course. So that's called ITRC's Integrated DNAPL Site Characterization Guidance, or ISC, ISC-1. That's what we're talking about here in this training. And it's outlined here in the figure on the right. When it has many advantages. We believe we developed this because it has many advantages and benefits. For example, improved CSM accuracy is the goal of the strategy, improved predictability of contaminant behavior and risk identification, better understanding of the contaminant distribution, and a roadmap for better communicating where sites are stuck, where the uncertainties are, you know, where are the uncertainties so that they can be addressed. This is also part of the roadmap to identify that. And ultimately, we want all this to come together to lead to better remedial remedy selection and targeting for better improvement. So on slide 11, so just to follow up on the DNAPL problem that I mentioned in the previous slide, here's the list that we came up with of what we think the outdated concepts, and then we've offered some of the replacements here. So I'm not going to go through this list because you're going to see it again later. I just want you to make a mental note to refer back here to this slide to see this comprehensive list. And the take-home point from this is that DNAPL characterization is more complex than previously thought, and that's largely due to the complex heterogeneity and not necessarily just the properties or behavior of the DNAPL itself. Okay. So with that, I'm going to talk about my last slide here is just talk about what you should be able to get out of this slide, this training. So first of all, we hope that you'll be able to apply this guidance to better support your projects. We hope that you'll understand the most important conditions affecting your conceptual site model. We hope that this will help you define a better approach to characterization, and we understand that help you understand that the best available tools for your data collection, and that's something we're going to spend a lot of time on later in the module that Jeremy's going to talk about. And lastly, what we want you to get out of this training is how to navigate the tool selection process. So with that, the last thing I'm going to say is if you gain nothing else, keep in mind the following things. That heterogeneity is controlling everything because it affects the pore structure, it affects the capillary properties, and these are the key things to contaminant distribution in the subsurface. There's high variability over small distances, and that's what this photo is trying to get at here. You can kind of see that there are these features in just a few inches of space, and what to what degree are these features in the subsurface controlling contaminant distribution, and then to what degree is that going to affect the targeting of your treatment methods and and the actual effectiveness of remediation. And lastly, the shape and topography of the permeability changes are key as well. So it's happening in multiple scales. This within inches, you've got variability, but then you've got it stacked on top of itself, both vertically and then also extending laterally. So we call that sort of topography, if you will. So with that, I will finally end my section here and turn this over to Tamsin McBeth with CDM Smith.
Thank you, Alec. So part of our training and the training overview is to really first go through DNAPL characteristics. So we're going to go back to DNAPL 101. And the reason that we're going to do this is because really the subsurface behavior of DNAPLs is really complex and is one of the reasons why these sites are so technically challenging. In addition, the DNAPL characteristics are what has made characterization tools and technologies advance over the last decade or so. And so really the objective of this document is to describe these tools and resources that can improve the identification, collection, and evaluation of appropriate site characterization data to provide or allow you to generate more accurate conceptual site models. This guidance really does describe what the current understanding of DNAPLs is, what tools and technologies can be used to measure physical, chemical, and hydrologic subsurface parameters, and I'm going to go through some of those in some of this upfront material, again, so that we can really better characterize and understand these systems. So first, it's important to understand, and just to set the stage here, we're really talking about DNAPLs generally, not just chlorinated solvents. And so here's some pictures of some common DNAPLs, and you can see it really is a broad class of chemicals that can include things like our typical chlorinated solvents, but also include things like coal tars, PCBs, and other types of chemicals. Some common types of DNAPLs, you know, can also include things like creosotes, petroleum or heavy hydrocarbons, bunker fuels, and really Chapter 2 of the guidance document reviews the DNAPL types, some general characteristics that control the distribution, fate, and transport of each of these chemical types, although it's also addressed in peer review literature. So poll question, if you would open that, Nicole, is what kind of DNAPLs are you dealing with at your site? This is a common list. You know, of course, as you can see, chlorinated solvents, it's always at the top of the list. Everyone is dealing with that within our industry because of the pervasiveness of those chemicals. But also things like petroleum hydrocarbons, which is reflected here, PCBs, creosotes, coal tars, pesticides. We even have some folks working at a mercury site and some other, you know, sites. So a broad mix of chemicals, you know, that I think represents the collective experience and represents the types of chemicals that we're dealing with at sites. So again, first in our DNAPL 101, we're going to go through properties that affect mobility. This includes things like density, solubility, viscosity, volatility, and composition, because each of these things really affect how these chemicals are transported and distributed within a subsurface environment. And the first thing is really what makes a DNAPL a DNAPL, and that's density. Higher density is represented by something called specific gravity, and that is the density relative to water. So DNAPLs, by definition, have a specific gravity greater than 1, meaning they're more dense than water. So this means they sink. And this is a really important property because what it means is when you spill DNAPLs in the subsurface, the transport of DNAPLs is driven much more by gravitational forces and gravity than it is by standard hydraulic gradients, like what we would think of in a lot of groundwater systems or aquifer systems. Next, it's important to understand the solubility of the DNAPL that you're dealing with, because this really affects how much of that chemical is going to dissolve from the DNAPL phase into water at equilibrium. So this represents the ability of that chemical to load or to solubilize into water. And you can have relatively high solubilities. In this table, we have a TCE with a solubility of 1,100 milligrams per liter. You can have chemicals with a very low solubility, like pentachlorophenol at wood treater sites. And you can have DNAPLs that are almost completely miscible or soluble in water. This really influences how these chemicals dissolve in water, but it also affects the persistence of the DNAPL. So things that have relatively low solubilities, those NAPLs tend to persist for very long periods of time relative to the chemicals that are more miscible. Another important characteristic is viscosity, and this represents the thickness or resistance to shear or flow of a fluid. For instance, honey is more viscous than water, which is more viscous than air. So DNAPL viscosity affects the rate at which a DNAPL can migrate through the subsurface, but it doesn't inherently influence whether or not it can. It influences its propensity to migrate, if you will. So this comes into play if there is mobile or highly saturated DNAPL, which we'll talk about. Viscosity is also influenced by other elements like temperature. And actually, the chart here shows different coal tars, the viscosity on the y-axis as a function of temperature. And you can see as temperatures increase, in general, viscosities decrease. And this is actually a remediation strategy where you can heat the subsurface to try to improve the ability to extract things like coal tar. So this really does influence that mobility of the DNAPL. Another important characteristic is volatility. This represents the tendency of a DNAPL or the DNAPL chemical to evaporate into the vapor phase. The volatility of DNAPL constituents as measured by vapor pressure, shown here, directly affects partitioning of these chemicals to the vapor phase, either directly from the DNAPL, if it's entrained in the beta zone, or from dissolved DNAPL constituents or a dissolved plume in groundwater. Mixed DNAPLs have a reduced vapor pressure because of a phenomenon called Routh's law. So the amount of chemical that's going to volatilize in a mixed DNAPL, say a hydrocarbon and a chlorinated solvent, is going to be different than in a pure phase chemical. This characteristic is also really important for understanding vapor intrusion, and ITRC actually has a guidance document on vapor intrusion that you should reference, and it has a lot more information about these characteristics. DNAPL composition is really important because very often we are thinking about DNAPLs as a pure chemical, but very often in our environment, the DNAPLs actually mix. You might have a chlorinated solvent mixed with things like grease or oils or stabilizers, petroleum hydrocarbons mixed LNAPLs, and DNAPLs is common. In addition, for complex NAPLs like creosotes, coal tars, petroleum hydrocarbons, those NAPLs can also weather, which means the composition of that NAPL changes over time as the more volatile and soluble constituents are removed faster than the heavier constituents. So it's really important that a lot of the chemical and physical characterization that we're talking about is done for your specific NAPL. So you can't necessarily pick up your Perry's Chemical Engineer's Handbook and look at properties, which is what we often want to do. You have to go and measure those properties for your site-specific NAPL. So now we're going to kind of transition. We talked about DNAPL properties and talk about properties that affect the way DNAPLs migrate in the subsurface or their mobility. And this includes things like interfacial tension, wettability, capillary pressure, saturation, and residual saturation, which I just mentioned a little bit ago. First, we're going to talk about interfacial tension and wettability. Wettability represents whether a fluid is wicked into or repelled out of a subsurface media. And it's defined by a contact angle of the DNAPL fluid against that matrix or media in the presence of water. Wettability is really a combined property of both the DNAPL and the subsurface formation that that DNAPL is present in. It can also be affected by the chemistry of the system and by the presence of other chemicals. So these adhesive forces, if you will, between the liquid and the solid can cause the liquid drop to spread across the surface. The figure in this slide shows the wetting of different fluids. The first figure shows a fluid with very little wetting, while the second shows a fluid with more wetting. And the contact angle, as seen in the figure, is the angle at which the liquid-vapor interface meets the solid-liquid interface. So this contact angle is determined by the result, again, of these kind of adhesive and cohesive forces of the solid and the liquid. Interfacial tension represents the force parallel to the interface of one fluid with another, usually air or water, and is really what results in the formation of a meniscus when capillary forces and pressure difference between fluids exist in the subsurface. So these properties, this interfacial tension, viscosity, density, and the porous media characteristics are what govern how DNAPLs migrate, whether they're wicking and whether they're wetting. In most cases, DNAPL is the non-wetting fluid and water is the wetting fluid. However, for some systems like aged creosote or coal tar sites with high saturations, DNAPLs can become the wetting fluids. So this really affects, again, how these DNAPLs migrate. Capillary pressure represents the pressure difference between the two fluids sharing a pore space within the subsurface. Due to interfacial tension and the formation of a meniscus, the wetting fluid, which is again usually the NAPL, develops a greater pressure than the wetting fluid, which is usually groundwater. So PC in this equation, or the capillary pressure, is a nonlinear function of the saturation, with it increasing at higher NAPL saturations. So that's a really important characteristic, and again affects if DNAPLs are mobile and if they're migrating. If those DNAPLs are overcome the capillary entry pressure at the water table, then they will migrate through that formation, and that really what dictates how deep the DNAPL migrate within the groundwater system. So just to represent these elements, this is actually a figure published by Bernie Cooper in the Illustrated Handbook of DNAPL Fate and Transport that represents the DNAPL pool heights in meters on the y-axis as a function of the media. So we have a very fine silt, a fine sand, a medium sand, and a coarse sand. And we also have different types of DNAPLs. We've got a creosote in red, a coal tar, a chlorinated solvent in yellow, and a mixed DNAPL. And what it shows is that the height of this DNAPL pool on top of this interface of silt is a function of both the grain size of this material and the type, where you've got the creosotes and the coal tars, highly viscous DNAPLs, will form larger pool heights compared to things like chlorinated solvents, you know, or this mixed DNAPL, and that the pool heights are also greater in the finer material. So pools will more readily form on top of silts and fine sands, and those DNAPLs would tend to more readily migrate through more coarse and medium sands. So that just illustrates really how these two elements, the property of the NAPL and the formation, really affect how DNAPLs pool or migrate in the subsurface. The next important consideration is saturation. Saturation represents the portion of the pore space that's occupied by the fluid, either the DNAPL or air or water, and it generally ranges from 0 to 1. So if all the pore space is occupied by a fluid, that saturation is 1. In general, DNAPL saturations very rarely approach 1, which means they generally occupy a smaller percentage of the total pore space. Residual saturation is a saturation level for drainable DNAPL, and I'll talk about that in a minute. This property, DNAPL saturation, whether it exceeds residual saturation or whether you have mobile DNAPL, is strongly affected by the geology of the site. And the more heterogeneous your system, the more residual saturation tends to be. And that's really illustrated as is shown here. In this case, the top figure, when the saturation is less than residual saturation, those DNAPLs are broken off and they're adhesed. Those cohesive forces are retaining the DNAPL, and this DNAPL is not mobile. It represents residual DNAPL at a low saturation. In the second case, when the DNAPL saturation is greater than residual saturation, you've got this interconnected DNAPL that's occupying a high percentage of the pore space. That represents potentially mobile DNAPL. So in this case, a continuous DNAPL face must be connected, and it must be at saturations that can overcome these entry pressures. We just talked about capillary pressure in order for this DNAPL to actually migrate. So another important characteristic is permeability of a system, which describes the potential for a fluid to transmit within that pore space. And it's a function, again, of both the fluid properties and the media. In groundwater systems, permeability is affected by the presence of DNAPL. And so the relative permeability shown here, this KR, is the permeability of the DNAPL system at the DNAPL saturation level. In this case, you have the second case, second figure. If you have a system that, all things being equal, has a permeability of 1 here, and that represents the permeability with water of that system. And then the second, that exact same system that's occupied by DNAPL, the effective or relative permeability is almost always less than 1, meaning that at significant DNAPL saturations, the apparent permeability for a formation is lower than what it would be represented by water. And this is very common in systems that have highly saturated DNAPLs. So now we're going to move on, and now that we've talked about DNAPL characteristics, and really talk about what we call the life cycle of a DNAPL site in the guidance document. And this really reflects a lot of current understanding about how the age of a DNAPL site and the time period that that chemical has been within the formation really affects where it's distributed, how it's distributed, and how it's being transported within that formation. And so we're going to use kind of a classical DNAPL conceptual site model where you have, and we're going to kind of go through several iterations of this. You have active, this is at the time of release, you've got a DNAPL, it's migrating down through that subsurface, again, it hits the water table, it continues to migrate till it comes into some finer grain materials, starts to spread laterally. This is kind of an early release, if you will. This release is occurring in time, at current time. So this is typically how a lot of older conceptual site models really conceptualize DNAPL sites. You've got a clear DNAPL source area. You've got a plume that's evolving over time. One of the things that has happened is as we get out, we implement some remediation, and things don't clean up. And what we've realized over the last decade is that what we're calling sources is not necessarily DNAPL or residual DNAPL. And often, you search and search and search most DNAPL sites, especially chlorinated solvent DNAPL sites, you actually don't ever find DNAPL. And everyone says, oh, we don't have DNAPL because we don't see it. But really, now what we're understanding is that DNAPL is no longer the only source, and that you really have to account for other secondary sources like sorption, desorption, and matrix diffusion. Because particularly for aged or older sites, it really is these metrics and these mechanisms that control the longevity of those dissolved phase plumes and result in persistent concentrations, often for decades. So now we've evolved from conceptual site models, which were really DNAPL focused, to now integrating the potential impact of these secondary sources like sorption and diffusion into our conceptual site models. And in the tools and technologies for characterization that Jeremy's going to go through, he'll talk about tools and technologies that can really define these different mechanisms and potential sources. So sorption as a secondary source is important. It's discussed in Chapter 2, and it really is what controls the ability of the formation itself or the solids to sorb chemical mass. So as those plumes evolve, as those chemicals are transported, they will sorb onto the aquifer matrix, and the rate that they desorb will often influence, again, the persistence of the chemical plume. So they affect the retardation factor, because as they're sorbing, as that plume is advancing, they're loading, if you will, onto that soil. It's increasing retardation, and then it also increases the length of time that persistent concentrations are observed, particularly at low levels when you're just above things like MCLs, and those levels will persist often for decades. The other important consideration, again, is diffusion. And this really is a phenomenon that's affected by the evolution of these high concentration plumes and just simple chemical diffusion or chemicals migrating based on gradient. So you have high concentrations along those flow paths, you have low concentrations in those clays or those lower permeability layers, and those chemicals just start to diffuse into the pore water of your low permeability zones. What happens decades later is that those higher conductivity zones clean out, they flush, and then you have all this mass stored in these low conductivity zones that come back in. Again, this back diffusion phenomenon really affects persistence of chemical plumes. This back diffusion is really driven by heterogeneity and preferential flow paths. Again, even systems where we think, hey, we're pulling up a soil core, this is sand, that sand looks pretty uniform. What we see is that the reality is almost all of our systems are heterogeneous, and that flow and transport of chemical plumes really occurs in higher transmissivity zones. Here we have this 10 to the minus 2 sand, and all the storage or sorption and diffusion occur in your low conductivity zones. Here, this sand that looks homogeneous, you have a 4 orders of magnitude difference in the apparent hydraulic conductivities. So these things really dramatically affect persistence of plume, and making sure that we understand what's termed the 14-compartment model. This was published by Sale and Newell in 2011, and really it's a methodology to help visualize how DNAPLs and chemicals are distributed in a subsurface system, and making sure that you're accounting for things like low permeability zones and transmissive zones in the sources where you're NAPL, and understanding that chemical flux, as is shown by the arrows, is occurring in all these different phases. You have DNAPL, you have vapor phase, you have aqueous phase, and you have sorbed. So understanding these fluxes, how chemical mass is migrating from the source to the plume, is really important, making sure that you're not missing an important element like matrix diffusion at your site, which is important to understand and important to account for as you're making remedial decisions, such as where do I implement treatment and what impact is an active treatment technology going to have on the apparent concentrations within these different compartments of a plume. So now sort of translating this 14-compartment model to our model that we just talked about, we have this early stage of a DNAPL site. You've got active migrating mobile DNAPL in this case. So we've got high DNAPL migrating in transmissive zones. You have volatilization, dissolution and sorption. The dissolution and evolution of a down gradient plume is starting to form. So this is our 14-compartment model at an early stage site. A lot of sites that have things like creosotes and coal tars really never get out of this early stage because of the properties of those low solubility, highly viscous bean apples, they really are always in this early stage, and you see this, you know, very highly saturated mobile napple for decades or centuries in the case of some of the sites I've seen. Next is what we call middle stage. In this case, you know, there is no mobile dean apple. You know, dean apple is not migrating. In this case, you've got this residual dean apple that's adhered into the formation. You've got a chemical plume, and you also have things like diffusion and sorption, which are loading up that chemical mass into low conductivity zones and onto soil. So in this case, 14-compartment model says you have a lot of mass. It's getting spread over much larger volumes and impacting different types of media. Another important thing to understand is that in the transport and looking at the impact of matrix diffusion, when we're modeling plume migration from sources, we were often using things like dispersion to tell us that you had high concentrations and that because of dispersion, the concentration profile really sort of took this log form, high concentration with low. And what we actually see is the reality is more like this. Dispersion is not typically significant. What's much more significant because of heterogeneity is flow zones, so sort of flow tubes with matrix diffusion creating these little halos. So that's an important shift, I would say, in our thinking and how we're developing the conceptual site model and, again, the impact of heterogeneity at the site. So big picture takeaway, heterogeneity replaces homogeneity. Almost all the characterization in the CSM updates that we talk about are saying you need to account for heterogeneity at your site. It is one of the most important things that will drive how dean apples progress, what the impact of your site remedy is. You can no longer assume homogeneous isotropic behavior. Last but not least is what we call the late stage in the dean apple life cycle. In this case, you really have no residual dean apple left, and now you just have this mass that's diffused into your low permeability layers and desorbing from your soil matrix. So you've got these moderate but persistent concentrations, again, because of these secondary sources. And that's, again, important, particularly if you have an older site to account for in your conceptual site model. So now we're going to go to a poll question. Now that I've gone through what this early, middle, and late stage means at a dean apple site and ask you, based on what I just presented, for the sites that you were reporting, all the different chlorinated PCB sites, do you think you're in an early stage, a middle stage, or a late stage? What elements, what types of sources are likely driving concentrations that you're observing at your site? And you can see by the poll response, we have a few early stage, so some folks that are working with mobile dean apple. You know, that mobile dean apple is still playing a big part in chemical transport, but the majority of folks are dealing with either a middle stage, so you've got a residual dean apple, maybe high concentration still acting as sources, but a lot of potential impact from sorption and diffusion represented in both middle and late stage. And this, again, is very indicative of the responses that we get in this poll question, I think indicative of the systems that we're really working with and now understanding better within our industry. So important takeaways. You need to understand your dean apple conceptual site model. You need to understand the properties of your dean apple, the properties of the media that those chemicals are in for your particular site. You need to understand the geology, the depositional environment, and the heterogeneity of that geology, because again, that really affects how dean apples migrate vertically, how they dissolve, how plumes evolve, and ultimately what the sources are likely for your site. You need to understand the characteristics of your specific DNAPL, make sure that you're getting your site-specific DNAPL properties so that you can understand how those chemicals are loading, either into the vapor phase or the dissolve phase, and understand where you're at within the DNAPL life cycle and the roles of matrix diffusion and sorption as secondary sources, and really manage the expectations for meeting remedial goals, accounting for all these really important characteristics. These are the elements that should be the basis of the objectives that you develop for your characterization. This whole guidance is really driven on characterization and better characterizing our sites. So really thinking about all these important characteristics is what is going to, and what you might be missing in your conceptual site model will drive developing your characterization objectives or your data quality objectives for your characterization program. And with that, I am going to transition into our first question and answer period.
Great, thank you, Tamsin. So at this point, this will be everybody's chance to go ahead and ask some questions. As a reminder, for those on the phone line that are interested in asking a question, I will give you that opportunity in just a minute. Remember that it's #6 to unmute your line. For anyone else, at any time, you can type in your question in the Q&A pod within the Adobe Connect screen, and we will get through as many of those questions as we can. Just a reminder for those of you that are interested in receiving certificates of completion, that will be available upon the completion of the feedback form. Once you complete the form and click the box to certify that you participated, we'll provide that certificate to you. So I'm going to pause and see if there's anybody on the phone lines that would like to ask a question. And once again, it's #6 to unmute. As we give everybody a minute on the phone to unmute if they have any questions, as a reminder, for anybody else that has a question on the first part of the presentation, please feel free to put them in the Q&A pods and we'll queue them up. Okay, I will take this opportunity to read one of the questions from the Q&A pod. How does co-solvation of DNAPL with an LNAPL plume affect the fate and transport of DNAPLs?
So this is Tamsin. There are actually several things that can really be affected by a mixed petroleum hydrocarbon and like chlorinated solvent NAPL. The first thing that is affected, especially if the NAPL's mixed, is the density. So LNAPLs are typically light. Their specific gravity is less than one, so they tend to float on the water table, which has completely different implications for how that NAPL will migrate. And actually, ITRC has some really great training on developing an LNAPL conceptual site model. So often what happens is you get a mixed NAPL that can have the properties, depending on how it was mixed, of an LNAPL or a DNAPL or something that's sort of neutrally buoyant. So that really influences how that NAPL migrates, how far it went into the water table, and whether it's behaving more like an LNAPL or like a DNAPL. And that's where really getting those site-specific NAPL properties becomes really important. We'll often see in those cases the NAPL density of one or very close to one. And sometimes you'll see where it might start out as an LNAPL, and then as that NAPL ages, the volatile constituents volatilize and dissolve, it actually ages into a DNAPL. So there's that. The other thing that mixed hydrocarbons and chlorinated affect is solubility. So in general, the composition of the NAFL is a function of the composition. So a pure phase TCE DNAFL is going to have a much higher solubility for TCE than a mixed NAFL because of Rouse law. So it has to do with molar percentages and the dissolution properties. So generally, you're going to see lower concentrations of a particular chemical that's in a mixed NAFL compared to if it was in a pure phase NAFL. So that can really affect. The other thing that it really impacts is the attenuation of the chemicals. So hydrocarbons can be biodegraded, and what we will often see is that mixed petroleum chlorinated sites are driven very anaerobic, and those anaerobic conditions will facilitate better or enhanced attenuation of chlorinated solvents, like chlorinated solvents like TCE or PCE. So those mixed NAFLs and what chemicals are dissolving in the plume, how biodegradable those chemicals are, affects the attenuation or the degradation, both biotic and abiotic, potential for that particular site. The other thing, I talked about solubility. The other thing that's affected is volatilization. So the dissolution properties, the volatilization properties, the attenuation properties, and the NAFL properties itself are all impacted with a mixed NAFL and behave differently than the pure hydrocarbon or chlorinated solvent or really any mix of chemicals. That's why you really have to account for each of those chemicals. And even if they're not a target, for instance, petroleum hydrocarbon sites or mixed sites, often the risk driver is the chlorinated solvent, not necessarily the hydrocarbon, but you have to account for the hydrocarbon because it impacts all of those things that drive distribution, fate, and transport of the chlorinated solvent. So you really do have to still account for it in your conceptual site model.
Great. Thank you, Tamsin. We have another quick question that I'm going to try to see if we can squeeze in time. What concentration of DNAFL can be considered a risk factor to human health?
Well, it depends on the pathways. So you have typically a direct contact pathway, you know, if somebody's handling DNAFL or they get DNAFL spilt on them or they're and generally, most DNAFLs, toxic DNAFLs, particularly like chlorinated solvents, PCBs, you know, things that we know are toxic, any direct contact exposure to the NAFL has adverse effects for human health. The other risk pathways to consider for DNAFL sites, so you've got direct contact, you have inhalation or vapor intrusion, which I talked about, that's really relevant for sites with volatile chemicals like chlorinated solvents. And so that risk pathway. And then you have drinking or consumption typically at sites. So your risk assessment has to account for all the potential pathways of exposure.
This is Alec at the Water Board. I should probably also answer that as a regulator. Yeah, everything Tamsin said is true. It's relatively rare that exposure is directly to a DNAFL because they tend to be sequestered in the ground, in the subsurface. So it's usually the effects of the DNAFL, the groundwater, the dissolved groundwater plume or the soil vapor plumes that are off-gassing from either DNAFL or high-concentration groundwater. And the amounts that are in the groundwater or the soil vapor that are you know present risk to human health are very small, so it's a problem.
Thank you to both. I'm going to encourage everybody to continue entering your questions into the Q&A pod. We are going to have a second Q&A session, but in the interest of continuing to move on, I'm going to turn the next part of the presentation over to Trevor. And as a reminder, Trevor, it's #6 to unmute.
Can you hear me?
Sound great. Thank you.
Okay, great. So thank you, Nicole. And thank you, Tamsin, for a very informative foundations principles of DINAPL 101. Every time I listen to this presentation, I learn something new. And good afternoon to everyone, depending on where you are, whether it's in the States, Europe, you know, France, Canada, or Africa. We welcome you. So this afternoon, we're going to talk about, you know, the characteristics of the DINAPL. And so far, you've heard about these characteristics, and we've also spoken of the life cycle of a DINAPL site. And what we want to do now is really discuss what we're calling the integrated site characterization process. You've heard the foundational principles given by Tamsin, and now we're going to talk about the practical aspects. And that basically includes three modules. There's a planning module, there's a tool selection module, and there's an implementation module. And we are going to go through each of them. I have the privilege of speaking specifically to the planning module after introducing the site characterization. So if we were to move on to the next slide, which is slide 49, what we want to do here is ask the question, what is integrated site characterization? I mean, we spent a lot of time, you're taking your time to listen to this presentation. So I wanted to kind of clear that up. We spoke about the roadmap. Alex spoke about the roadmap, which you can see on the right of your slide. So this is a roadmap that what we consider to be a very flexible and an adaptive 8-step process. So there are three modules: planning, tool selection, and implementation, and there are 8 steps associated with this roadmap. And it's all designed to refine an existing conceptual site model, if one is there, or to help you to develop one in the future. From the poll questions, I see many sites are already in a stage of being advanced, so more than likely there's a conceptual site model of some sorts already existing. So with the characterization, depending on where you are in this whole process, you want to be able to focus on several things. You want to be able to focus on the data that is already there. And this is all tailored towards DINAPL sites and some of the problems that this team, with over 500 years of experience, have really sat down over a couple of years and tried to bring that pool of knowledge to the table and put in this guidance document. And what we found out is that there was a lot of problems still existing with the data resolution and how that translates into the scale of the heterogeneity, as Tamsin was alluding to in her description. We also found that the objectives for many of the characterization programs in the past were not very clear, and they were not necessarily flexible or actionable. So we wanted to kind of work on that and try to provide this roadmap that we are outlaying here today to help to answer these questions more realistically and cost-effectively as well. Then we extended it even further by looking at the tools that are most appropriate to achieve the characterization. Again, this is all tailored around characterization of your subsurface. The next slide, which is slide 50. So we can do all of this, and we're spending quite a bit of money and meeting the regulations, working as consultants or stakeholders. But unless what we're doing has value and is bringing benefit to someone, then it doesn't really make sense. So some of the benefits that the team agreed on, and there were several of these benefits identified, and many of them are recapped in the guidance document. But some of them spoke to, you need to be able to reduce the uncertainty with your characterization program. And what we are outlaying here today is designed to do that. And I hope at the end of this presentation, you'll be much more comfortable in figuring out how you can implement a program that reduces the uncertainty with your new or your existing conceptual site model. The benefit also of characterization is that it is used to help to develop a more efficient remedial action or a more efficient remedy. And in 2011, as shown here, this team worked on a DINAPL site strategy document, which was really the forerunner of what we're doing here, because an outcome of this document, the DINAPL site strategy document, was the finding that a lot of the problems that we're facing today came from poor characterization. So what we're doing here is intended to kind of help to reduce the inefficiencies with poor remedial actions. As we know, everything we do, you know, affects someone's bottom line. So if we do something that doesn't really achieve an endpoint, an agreed endpoint, then it calls for redoing it. And we know that redoing some of our work is very costly. So we want to avoid costly do-overs with our program. And very important, depending on which side of the the table you're sitting, you want to have a program that all stakeholders, it could be the regulators, the clients, it could be developers, it could be the public, that are all on looking. You want to make sure that whatever you develop and the data you have supports an action that everyone can buy into and they have confidence in that action. So those are some of the benefits. So we are now on slide 51 for those who are moving their slide, and we want to talk about the integrated site characterization process in a little bit more detail. So here we have on the right side is the roadmap that we've mentioned a couple of times, and at the beginning of the presentation, Alex spoke about it, and here I am developing it a little further. We can see that what is shown here is the planning phase. So the planning phase of the characterization program, which is where I spend most of my time, has four steps associated with it. And it's important for us to grasp, what the planning phase entails, because if we cannot plan and achieve these objectives in these four steps, it will lead to the collection of insufficient data, poor quality data, and if you collect something that is not useful, you're going to implement a remedy that is not going to achieve a specific endpoint. So with the planning phase of the characterization program, the first thing we want to do, depending on if we have a conceptual site model in place or not, is to be able to define the problem. And you want to be able to assess what uncertainties may exist at your site. And as I said, if you have an existing conceptual site model, you want to re-evaluate that conceptual site model. We have to recognize that the conceptual site model is like a living tool, a living document. In the 90s or earlier, we developed these conceptual site models as part of the process and basically parked them in a desk or a drawer as we moved into remediation and post-remedial actions and monitoring. But what we've realized that we can only collect so much data, and the plan is to collect sufficient data to help you to move through the process, continually circling back and updating your conceptual site model until you get to a place where you begin to achieve your milestone. So first thing, we got to define the problem at your site. Once we define the problem, then we can begin to look more strategically to identify, well, I have this problem. What is it? Is it a soil problem, a groundwater problem, is it a vapor intrusion problem? That helps us to figure out what are the data needs and how much resolution is required in order to answer the question surrounding this problem. Next, we want to be able to develop the data collection objective. So basically, if you don't have a good roadmap and you don't know what you want to achieve, you're going to end up with problems, because it can be very difficult to establish and to convince someone that you've reached a specific endpoint. So you've got to be able to develop collection objectives that are very clear, and we'll talk about that in a little bit more detail, because they have to be clear and they have to be smart. And I explain what that means in the next couple of slides. And finally, with all of this data, we need to be able to put this down in some format that can be used by not only the stakeholders, the clients, but also the folks who are doing this work, who's going to take it to the field. So we have to write a plan, and the plan has to be flexible, it has to be adaptive, and it has to be, answer the questions surrounding this characterization program we continuously speak about. Finally, the second module, rather, is about selecting the right tools to accomplish this job. So that is step 4. And Jeremy is going to speak about that in more detail, and I'm always excited to hear of the new tools that have been developed over the last couple of decades that are now benefiting our practice, our field, our discipline. And last but not least, you identify the problem, you have a plan, you select the right tools. Now somebody has to go into the field and implement this investigation. So you go in there, you execute your plan, you collect data, you take that data, you process it, and then what you do? You circle back to your conceptual site model to make sure that if there were any data gaps, they were filled as part of the part of this work. And this basically helps you to move into the next phase, once completed, into developing, let's say, a remedial strategy, which is the document that I spoke about earlier, integrated Indianapolis site strategy document. So I want to ask a question. These poll questions are very valuable because the presenters basically use them to help to guide or to tweak their presentation. So the poll question I have for you is, you have a Indianapolis site that is being characterized for the first time or where prior characterization was insufficient. You got a couple of answers, yes, first time insufficient, no. Immediately I can see, yes is insufficient, is, way ahead on the scale, which basically is typical of what we've seen because Indianapolis, have been around for several decades, and what we have found over the years, and this again is based on the experience of the team, that traditionally we did a certain amount of characterization, we wrote a report, we discussed it, we went back to the field, and over time, the spatial resolution and the heterogeneities that exist in the subsurface have led to very poor conceptual site models, which have translated into poor efficiencies and incomplete remedial actions. So, what we see here is, it's typical of what we've seen in the past. So I want to get into, before I get into the planning module, which I'll speak about, I want to clear up I want to answer one question that many of you may be asking, and this kind of bore out from past presentations and experiences to even during the preparation of this document. The question you may ask yourself, either during or the end of the presentation, well, what is it these guys really spoke about? The US EPA data quality objectives have been around for quite some time, and they have 7 steps in there that answers all the questions that these guys seem to be speaking about. Well, the simple answer to that question is, when we were developing our guidance document, we took all of these 7 steps into consideration. Whereas the data quality objectives established by the US EPA is for all programs, we try to focus specifically on Indianapolis and the problems associated with Indianapolis. So those 7 steps that you see outlaid on the right of this on the left of this slide, were combined and condensed into the 4 steps I will be speaking about. Defining the problem, identifying the data needs, establishing the data collection objectives, and designing the process. So they are actually captured there. But what we wanted to do is to extend the characterization process to be more helpful to our practitioners. That's why we have the tool selection process as well as the implementation process packed onto our roadmap. That's why we call it the 3-8 roadmap, 3 modules, 8 steps. It's basically used to help me to remember when I'm doing this work or sharing with others. So here we are. we're going to talk about planning and the four steps I'm going to discuss. I want to make one statement. All of what we are discussing as part of this portion of the presentation, plus the remainder of the presentation, is included in chapters 4 to 6 of the guidance document. As I go through each of the steps of the planning module, I will outlay an example site, and we are going to discuss each of these in the context of our example site to see how it works. And so it gives you a little bit more confidence that you know, there is really not just theory, but there is actually a practical aspect, and hopefully it begins to train your mind on how this can be used. So as you mentioned, the first step is about defining the problem and assessing the uncertainties. So, you know, this is often, you know, can often be a challenge in terms of, you know, defining the problem and defining the uncertainties. What does this all mean? Because, you know, it can be very confusing at times. So, for example, if you're at the site, you may say, well, I have a problem. Maybe the plume, you know, the extent of the plume is not fully defined. So in that case, what is really the uncertainty, you may ask yourself? Is it about maybe we have a low data density in a particular direction, which is why there's a lot of you know, unknowns ongoing and it's affecting our remedial action? There can be a case where we collected groundwater data, we didn't consider maybe tidal effects, maybe we traversed across different aquifers, we didn't consider the gradients. So that has lent, that may lead to all different types of uncertainties. You may have another problem. You may have a remedial action in place, and it's not working. So then you ask yourself, well, what's the uncertainty here that I need to consider? It depends. It, sometimes it could be the source area. It's probably not fully understood, as in the example site we will talk about. Or maybe those preferential pathways that Tamlin alluded to is affecting the effectiveness of your remedial action, and they were not necessarily considered in the design. So you need to be able to define the problem, identify the uncertainties, and then you take that information and roll it back to your conceptual site model if one exists. When you are looking at your conceptual site model, and Tamsin you know, kind of spoke about some of these, you would look at your conceptual site model in a couple of you know, areas. You want to be able to look at the lithology and the structural heterogeneity, because we know that these all affect the behavior of transport, groundwater flow, and contaminant distribution in the subsurface. We also want to look at the vertical you know, profile of your treatment zone or treatment area, because depending on how the data was collected, you may have used continuous cores, you may have taken cores at different frequencies, you may have collected groundwater from wells or, you know, from discrete samples. Depending on what was done, it can all affect the interpretation of your conceptual site model. You need to also consider, you know, the historical sources. You know, is it an old plume? Is it a young plume? Is it, you know, are there storages used? You know, this all affects your conceptual site model. And last but not least, because we are speaking about DNAPLs, excuse me, we need to consider the chemical constituents and what you know, what they make up. Is it parent compounds? Is it you know, daughter products we are seeing? All of that has to be considered. So here we are. This is, I want to kind of just develop this for a moment. And this is really our example site. It is actually a site that one of our team members worked on, you know, back in the, you know, 2011 or thereabout. And it was a site that was in place for several years. So what is shown here, and this basically, this example is going to use throughout the remainder of this presentation. So by a quick update, this is a dry cleaner site. It's about half an acre. The depth to, and it's in a commercial and residential location. To the north, residential properties. To the east, you have a gas station and some apartments. To the south, residential properties. And, you know, to the west, know, you had several garages. So that dry cleaner was in operation from, you know, probably the 1950s. Was taken out of use around 2008. But between 2004 and 2008, some investigations were conducted. The depth of groundwater, I wanted to add, is about 50 feet below grade, and the direction of groundwater flow is towards the southeast. So back in 2004, when investigation of this site, in addition with a couple of others, were done in the area, they actually installed 5 monitoring wells and 80 soil borings. So as you look at this figure, you will see that, you know, there are some red circles and some green circles. The green circles represent the findings below, you know, the criteria, and the red circles speak to the exceedances of both soil and groundwater, you know, in this dry cleaner, at this dry cleaner site. So they collected groundwater samples. They collected, you know, they installed 18 borings, but what they did not do between 2004 and 2007 is collect soil gas data. Now, one may say, well, you know, that seems crazy. Why wouldn't they have collected soil gas data back then? Well, we got to recognize that back in 2004, thereabouts, VI was not as prominent as it is today. They were also limited by access to off-site properties, so basically, very little and no work was done with respect to soil gas. What they did is they did this work, all these borings and monitoring wells as appropriate, and they defined an area that they considered the source area. And that's basically shown in this blue circle here, which is about 700 square feet. And they basically implemented a program, a source area treatment for this area using in situ chemical oxidation, both for the unsaturated zone, and they extended it to the saturated zone down to about 25 feet. For the dissolved plume, which is represented by the black hatched line, they injected nutrients to enhance the in-situ bioremediation of that dissolved plume. So this work was all done in 2008 after the characterization was completed. So several years went by, and by 2010 they went back to investigate the site and found that, you know what, there were some problems. This system, you know, was not working. So they had to go back to the drawing board, and that's where my colleague on this guidance document team, they were involved, and they had to do an analysis. And what they found is that there was a lot of uncertainty with respect to the plume delineation. For example, if you look at this plume, and Nicole, I am looking for my pointer. Anyway, there you are. So to the east, you can see there are very few borings installed, and there was only one well to the northeast, and that was clean. But there was very little work done off-site and to the north, to the southeast. When you look at the southern area of the site, there was very little data. Again, they were limited by access to these properties, similarly to the west. So they did some work, and they confirmed, or they made a determination that this blue area was the source area. So they inferred that. One thing they did not do, and you may ask the question, that seems obvious. Well, today it may be obvious, but maybe back then it was not. They did not come up with a plan to monitor the effectiveness of the in-situ chemical oxidation or the biological treatment of the dissolved plume. Neither, as I mentioned, did they take soil samples to assess the VI at this site. So those were some of the uncertainties that were identified at this example site, and that will be discussed in further detail during the presentation. So I want to move on to the next step, which is step two. And it speaks to identifying the data needs and the type of resolution that is required to basically build your site characterization plan. So again, it's all about identifying the uncertainties, the data needs associated with that, and then figuring out how much needs to be done to determine the resolution so that you can collect the right and appropriate amount of data in order to assess, for example, the controlling heterogeneities in the formation and to develop a very strong characterization plan. So if we were to look at this in terms of the example site once more, what was identified at this site was, and I here have in bullets or in bold, the groundwater samples that were collected. There were just 5 wells at this site. And you can see how they were scattered around the site, with just 3 of them being within the area of the dry cleaner. The off-site was unknown, particularly the southern area of the site. So the delineation of the plume, both laterally as well as vertically, was actually was very poor, to say the least. So a lot of work would have been needed to correct this. Also, while we may think, well, they had 18 borings and they collected so many site samples per boring, what we found, or what the consultant found, is that still, because they did not consider some of these issues with heterogeneity, et cetera, that Tamsin spoke about, the distribution and the understanding in the subsurface was still also lacking. And needless to say, soil gas remained an issue at this site. So here, the whole idea again is to think holistically, not only of the immediate work that needs to be done, but how does it translate into, you have to keep revisiting your conceptual site model if one exists, and what is needed to actually answer the question to complete a strong and robust site characterization for your site. Moving, let me go back. I double-clicked. I just thought I'll point out this slide. This is actually a cross-section, and this is not fabricated. This is all real data and the real finding from this Indiana site. Here you can see the section, and if you think if you look at the soil samples in green or red along that blue transect, can you share the pointer, please, Nicole? You will see that. Thank you. So here we have a couple of data points, both soil and groundwater, and if you go to the cross section, you can see the work that was done in the unsaturated zone. At the beginning, I said the depth of water was approximately 15 feet below grade. So most of the work was done in the unsaturated zone, with a couple of the wells penetrating the aquifer down to 25 feet. But here, what is shown is that in the southeastern area of the site, they actually went down to about 15 feet, and based on the data, it was confirmed that you had some type of delineation down to that depth. However, as you go from east to west, you can see how the understanding across that site, east to west, was very limited. This is not fabricated. This is actual data and an actual understanding using the site data for this conceptual site model. Next slide. So step 3 is basically about establishing your data collection objectives. There are a couple of points I want to make with this. As you develop collection objectives, your objectives need to be very clear, they need to be very specific, and they need to be actionable. A lot of work was done as part of the integrated Indianapolis site strategy, where it speaks about these types of objectives. They actually call it SMART objectives because they wanted to put a time frame associated with these objectives. So you're not saying you're going to delineate your site in 10 years or 15 years. You know, we want to be able to say we will delineate our site, as an example, or characterize our site in, you know, 6 months or 12 months, whatever that time frame. So it needs, things need to be very specific, clear, and actionable. Also, we need to be able to consider all the different types of you know, of data that are needed. We need to understand how much is needed, the quality of the data, and what type of spatial resolution we actually need in order to either develop a conceptual site model or to refine our conceptual site model. So establishing your data collection objectives is a critical element of the planning module. So if we go back to the example site, here we're talking about objectives. So I want to look at the site in terms of setting objectives. As you think of objectives, what we recommend is that you establish a hierarchy. In other words, you establish a broad objective for your site, and then you drill down and refine that. So for the example site, that may look like we want to be able to delineate the extent of the dissolved plume and use that data to determine the stability and the attenuation rate. Now, I said a couple of things in the previous slide. It needs to be clear, actionable, and you need to be able to confirm or to be able to demonstrate that you've met these objectives. So as stated, this high-level broad objective doesn't really answer that question, which is why it becomes important for us to develop sub-objectives, you know, if you will. In other words, we need to be established for the team. We want to collect groundwater samples, and we want to establish where we want to do so. And in this case, we say we're going to collect groundwater samples at this site, and it's going to be collected based on prior knowledge at X and Y depths. They also decided that they want to establish you know, additional salt borings. And based on the current understanding, you want to do X number of, you know, every X number of feet, for example, to capture the subsurface variability. Now, this is something that really needs to be developed in consultation with, let's say, qualified you know, practitioners. In other words, you need to have your geologist, your hydrogeologist involved. You need to have your chemist involved. You need to have your remediation engineer involved. So everyone is bringing their, you know, their perspective and basically developing a program that has value to the end objective of, in this case, you know, characterizing your subsurface. Another task that you may want to accomplish for this broad task, you want to be able to figure out, well, what is it we are going to be looking to achieve? Is it going to be a drinking water standard? Is it going to be you know, some other standard that's agreed to by a regulator? So you need to establish that upfront during this planning phase. And you need to, based on that information, you may say, you know what, I need to install some additional wells. How many wells? So you kind of use your professional judgment and come up with a number. Again, the program is flexible and adaptive. You get into the field and you realize you need more, you can, you know, do more. Or if you need less, you do less. But you don't just stop there. You need to figure out, well, when I collect that data, you know, what am I going to do with it? Am I going to analyze it? How often am I going to collect the data? And so you have some additional, you know, metrics here. You're going to collect it for 2 days, 2 years, or whatever the case. How are you going to process or handle the data? What is it you're specifically going to be looking at, the COCs or the geochemical parameters? So by the time you get to this point and you establish your objectives, you know, everyone should pretty much be in agreement with your plan for characterizing this site. So I have one more, you know, two more slides, but I wanted to kind of interject with a poll question, which asks the question, you know, in our practice, and depending on your age at which, you know, how long you've been in this business, you know, the data collected over the years, has it been optimal for deciding what you do next? Is it a yes or no response? And basically, overwhelming, yes. So, I mean, that makes sense, you know, because we have advanced over the last, I would say, decade, and particularly in the last 5 years, with the refinement of tools, et cetera, that thereby allows us to do a better job at characterizing our site. So the actual data collection objective established for this example site was to define the plume exceeding the groundwater standards. They wanted to assess the remedy progress, which was not in place by 2010 and 11. They also needed to look at vapor intrusion and take soil gas samples, and they wanted to basically streamline the assessment. The initial assessment was completed over 4 years, but the client, because of certain things that were going on, needed to have this done in days, as a matter of fact, not even weeks or months. So the task of the consultant was a large one. So in addition to the objectives, they figured out what was needed from a resolution standpoint. They decided they're going to collect cores, collect groundwater samples every 4 feet, and soil gas samples every 5 to 10 feet. So that sounds good, but you needed to do a little bit more. You needed to be able to get to step 5, which is really, we got to put this down on paper. We got to write a plan. So having recognized all the data limitations associated with this problem, they were able to select the data management tool that you're going to be used to process this data, and that's critical. You're not just going out into the field and collecting data. You have to think about, how am I going to process this data? Can I process it in a timely manner that helps me to refine the characterization that is ongoing into the field, ongoing in the field? And then to be able to develop an analysis process. And of course, there's always the plug for real-time analysis, because in this day and age, we have mobile labs, we have the triad approach that was actually used at this site, and there are several refinements that can better enhance the work we do and basically be very cost-effective compared to what it was in years previously. At this example site, basically they used a triad approach. They collected soil gas samples, a mobile lab. They were actually able to do 80 samples per day. And one thing I didn't mention, this was one of three sites that the client owned that were within a 5 mile radius. So they had the benefit of working at three sites over a 10-day period. They actually estimated that this work at the three sites would be done in 15 days, and they were actually able to complete it in 10 days, thereby saving the client some money. So the final step is really looking at what was done at this example site. So basically, in consultation with the practitioners and the stakeholders and the regulators eventually, they agreed that they would install 16 borings. Nicole, the pointer, please. So the yellow triangles identifies, the basis and the selection of these sample locations for these 18 borings. And they then decided that they were going to collect samples every five samples per boring, and groundwater samples at each of the locations, and three samples per boring, because, again, the depth of water was between 15 and 25 feet. So they identified the areas. As you can see, specifically, they wanted to spend some more time in the source area, and they actually went southeast, which was down gradient. They still had some limitations with access at the site, so they were kind of constrained. But with this program recommended and approved, they were able to get out to the site and actually complete this work very cost effectively. In addition to the groundwater and the soil samples, they collected soil gas. So they identified 12 points, primarily in the residential areas that were not investigated before, and they collected two samples, one at 5 feet and one at 10 feet at these locations, and were able to take that data and basically use it to update the conceptual site model, both the soil data, the groundwater data, and now the new VI data. So this is my last slide. And basically, it summarizes, what I have covered or try to cover in the last several minutes. So we basically spoke about the roadmap, which is a three-module program that has 8 steps. Modules being planning, tool selection, and implementation. And then I took some time and I spoke specifically about the 4 steps in the planning module. There we kind of defined the problem, identified the data gap, developed the objectives, again, SMART objectives, and we wrote that into a plan. My last thought is that I want to leave with you. Don't be confused with data quality objectives. It's actually included in the site characterization planning phase. The whole focus, again, with our roadmap is to focus on the problems and issues that are specific to the DNAPL sites. So I hope I've been able to at least stimulate you to think in terms of how to go about characterizing your site and how to plan appropriately. At this point in time, I'd like to hand it over to Nicole and to Jeremy, who will speak about tool selection.
Thank you, Trevor. I'm going to step back a little bit into the sequence of events here. And, we realized as we were developing the document that there were a lot of tools out there, but we all, as the industry and practice area, tended to cycle to the investigation methods that we were most familiar with. And other options that were out there were either rarely used or poorly understood. So we developed a tool selection framework that could help drive practitioners and regulators and stakeholders to other options that maybe help us characterize sites a little bit more efficiently. So we'll run through an orientation of the tools matrix, which is a downloadable Excel table, macro-driven, that gives us some selection framework and filters. We'll run through the functionality of that matrix and other information that it can drive you to, and then we'll wrap up with some case studies, including circling back to the case study that Trevor introduced earlier in his section. So let's start with a quick poll. And over the course of the time that we've been doing this presentation, our answers have actually changed a little bit, but we want to see which tools have you used or are you familiar with from your sites. And what we find is that everybody can go old school with a split spoon sampler, as shown in this poll, but some of these other methods that are shown lower on this list, obviously shown here, are definitely less used on sites. And so what we want to do is we want to get people an opportunity to identify more tools that may be options for them. So the matrix is downloadable. You can get to it linked through the Kluwen website and linked here in the presentation. If you click on that first bullet, it should take you to the download. Our tools are segregated into categories, subcategories, and such that have been selected by our subject matter experts in developing the document. It's intended to be a living resource to be updated periodically. The reality is it's difficult to coordinate and update things over time. The probably most updated version of things you'd find in the Fractured Rock document, which you can also find a similar table, similar functionality on the ICRC website. The tools matrix, it contains over 100 tools. I think it's somewhere in the neighborhood of 120 tools. They're sorted by our characterization objectives that are defined earlier in the site characterization planning process. Their effectiveness and different types of media, unconsolidated zones, bedrock, data zones, unsaturated, saturated zones, and the type of data that they give. So quantitative, semi-quantitative, or qualitative. And then within the table, we can get more information on why something is important. So here, if we click on the geology header, we can go into a narrative description of why the geology characteristics are going to be important to our site characterization and how we may use those in making decisions. Similarly, we can click on any of the tools, and it will bring up a list of references to get more in-depth information, general description of that tool, type of data quality and its applicability at sites, and then the limitations that we're going to find when we try to implement that tool. And then if we just look at the matrix overall, we can see through the green shading what that tool may be applicable for, and really get a pretty big 30,000-foot view of our options. But still, it's going to be hard to sort through 120 tools with a lot of green boxes. Isn't really that user friendly. So we've added some filters to the matrix that allow us to down select our appropriate tools to meet characterization objectives. It's a systematic and iterative process where you would select your categories: geology, hydrogeology, or chemistry, the parameters of interest, and the geologic media, as well as the potential saturation of your subsurface zone, and your data quality type, quantitative, semi-quantitative, or qualitative. Then we can apply those filters and evaluate the tools that result from those filters for their effectiveness, availability in your local area, and then relative cost. And it's important to always understand it's just a tool to help us get to some options, but it's going to be up to the professional, the practitioner, to really identify the ones that are most appropriate to the site based on our team's experience, availability, the cost, repeatability, and whether or not new information is out there that maybe changes some of our use of that tool. So just a quick run through of how this looks. The first thing that we do is we select our category. You'll notice that there are multiple subcategories under chemistry. And we can always leave that type as all, and it will return a much larger selection. And then in the next bit, the parameters of interest are focused then down on only those that lie under our primary category. And are related to that. Then we would select our parameter, our geologic media that we're interested in, the zone, and our data quality requirements. Then once we run the filter, we click search. And you'll see that it provides a summary of what our search parameters were at the top, in a new tab in our table. And I'm getting a little bit click happy. And then once the filters are applied, it reduces our list of 120 some odd tools down to those that are can be applied to our site characterization objective. We can add additional parameters, or we can do an additional search within that same table, so we can save that to a project file and refer back to it down the road by just running a new search on this main tab. We can also add parameters to a previous search. I find this to be a little bit more limited in its use because it adds more parameters to your search rather than further refining it down to fewer tools. So then once we run through our filtering process, we're going to incorporate those tools into our characterization planning, implement that plan, evaluate the resulting data, update our model, and reassess our characterization objectives to identify any data gaps that still remain, whether or not we've met our data density requirements and have a sufficient model to be able to move to our next steps. And as I said before, it's an iterative process, so we can repeat this selection as necessary. So
let's take a jump back into a case example. This goes back to the example Trevor reintroduced earlier. And the objective of this would be to delineate the lateral and vertical extent of dissolved phase plume and determine the stability and rate of attenuation. So our goals focused on defining the boundary of the groundwater exceedances, assess the progress of the remedy that had been implemented in soil and groundwater to date, and assessing the shallow soil vapor impacts. So our filter types, when we look at that, we're looking at the all of our chemistry, so that's soil, groundwater, and soil vapor, with the contaminant concentration as our focus. And the unconsolidated media, we're not specifically focused on saturated or unsaturated zones, so we select all, and we're looking for quantitative results. So we show here how we selected those filters, and the resultant search returns this subset of tools, which from 120 gave us 22 to work through. And then when we, as a project team, we'd look at those tools and evaluate what the priorities were for us. And so looking at our desire to expedite the assessment, project team would select the direct push borings with continuous soil sampling and grab groundwater sampling, as well as active soil gas survey and mobile lab with direct sampling ion trap mass spec. The 22 tools, a lot more manageable than 120. So kind of quickly moving through a few other, two other case examples. These are just sort of hypothetical. First one, determine the porosity of fractured bedrock formation in a source zone and evaluate the potential storage capacity. So that's a geology question focused on porosity in the bedrock and our saturated zone. For this, let's say we're okay with a qualitative result. So we apply those filters, and we come back with 10 tools that will help us get those results. And then our third example, evaluating the potential matrix diffusion issues. So this is a hydrogeology question or objective, and looking at hydraulic conductivity in the unconsolidated zone or unconsolidated lithology in our saturated zone. Here, we're not exactly sure what we're dealing with for availability of tools, so we look at all of our data quality options. Applying those filter returns a bigger set than we potentially are interested in looking at. So if we refine that and we change our data quality objective only to qualitative, then we reduce that down and we only come out with 7 tools that meet our characterization objective. So just in summary, the characterization objectives guide our selection of tools. The matrix has over 120 tools that provide links to descriptions of their use, limitations, applicability, and advantages. Our selection process is iterative and systematic. And once we select our tools, we implement those in the work plan, evaluate our results, and then align data gaps with characterization objectives and update the conceptual site model and repeat it if necessary. So that's the tools matrix, and I'll turn it over to Ryan to go through implementation.
All right, thanks, Jeremy. We're on the home stretch here, so I'm going to talk for a few minutes about the last segment of the integrated site characterization process. So we heard from Trevor to take us through the planning module. Jeremy just talked us through the tools. So now I'm going to quickly go through implementation. So slide 99, this is where we're actually going out in the field conducting the investigation. So we're implementing everything that we set out to do through our planning module, using the tools that we've selected with the tools matrix, and actually going out and doing the work. Step 7 is performing data evaluation and interpretation. Step 8 then is updating the conceptual site model and kind of tying everything together. So for step 6, like I mentioned, this is where we're going in the field. Ideally, we've set up some level of flexibility in our investigation plan where we're able to make decisions in the field based on conditions and data that we're generating using real-time or near real-time data and tools that generate that type of data. So the important point here is that step 6 and step 7 are often done concurrently. So because we're using these tools that provide data, you know, immediately in the field or within hours, we want to take advantage of that. So we don't want to go out and do a bunch of field work for weeks on end without ever looking at the data, because we're missing substantial opportunities to adapt our field investigation program. So for step 7, this is where we want to consider how we're going to use the new data we're collecting. I'll get back to our case study here in a minute, but for really any site where you're going through this process, if there was some data that were collected historically and now you're collecting new data, maybe with some of the latest and greatest high-resolution site characterization tools, you have to determine how you're going to fit the old data in with the new data, because in some cases the historical data may be, you know, just completely you know, worthless, and you don't want to look at any of it because it was collected with, you know, means and methods that we don't use anymore. But more likely, the older data still has some value. So you have to determine how you're going to integrate the new data with the old data. The idea being you want to generate these collaborative data sets that everyone on the project team can kind of dig into. So, you know, project manager, stakeholders, clients, field folks, you know, lead engineers, lead scientists, et cetera. So we always advocate a multiple lines of evidence approach when evaluating sites. So you may be looking at data related to contaminant transport versus storage, like we heard about earlier in the training, as well as attenuation mechanisms. So back to our example site. Here we have some updated results. They're shown using the same sort of simplistic presentation where green is above or below and red is above criteria. The triangles are monitoring wells and the circles are soil boring. So this is what everything looks like with the new data. So we've got an example posted here of the vertical profile of soil concentrations of this boring here in the center of the figure. You can see that data were collected using the mobile lab every 2 feet out here, and you see, which is, you know, pretty common with soil data, some variability. So a couple of things I want to point out. One is that the fixed lab result at the very shallowest depth ended up not really matching very well the corresponding mobile lab result. So this was something that the project team, you know, had to address as they were doing the data interpretation at this site. As it turned out, this was, you know, likely due to just heterogeneities, because even though the samples are from the same depth, it's not necessarily the same sample, as we know, doing soil investigations. But anyway, this is something that they definitely had to deal with and account for. The other split samples at the site ended up being in a lot more agreement than this example. But we want to show this because, you know, field programs are not, things don't always go perfectly. But the bigger point is the variability. So if we remember, this site had used, I think, 5-foot interval sampling for the soil data before, So let's say if you picked an interval, you know, something from like 5 to 10 feet, you can see you would be kind of mixing and averaging a non-detect up to an 11.5 milligrams per kilogram. So it shows, you know, the value of the higher resolution that was used here. So in terms of refining the plume footprint, this shows the old plume outline in black and the new plume outline in red. So you can certainly see it's a little bit different, and probably the most important difference is down in this part of the site where you have groundwater with elevated contaminant concentrations moving in this direction toward and presumably beneath, you know, apartments and houses. So that certainly was a big deal out here. This investigation showed that the source area still had elevated concentrations. If you remember when Trevor presented, this was a part of the site where they were implementing in-situ remediation, IFCO, I believe, concentrations still really weren't going down. So more on that in a minute. The other big element that was implemented in this investigation was soil vapor. Certainly, this is something that, you know, we would see in present day and quickly realize this should have been a part of the original investigation. It wasn't, and this figure shows, you know, of course, that it should have been, because here we have the results shown. In this case, there's three different colors. Red is above, you know, greater than a subchronic screening level. Blue is a result that exceeds a chronic screening level, and then green is below. So you see a lot of reds and blues out here, which certainly shows the soil vapor exposure pathway is, you know, a concern out here. There's only a couple, you know, results kind of around the perimeter that were below the screening levels, but you see in the core of this plume, they're all above. So in just like I did for the soil data, here's a couple of results from the soil vapor. Remember, the plan was to collect two different depths, so these are those results here. And you can see the agreement was a little bit better between the fixed lab and the mobile lab here. So one last poll question. Thinking of step 8, when do you typically update your conceptual site model at the sites that you work on? So is this whenever, you know, every time you get new data, maybe when a remedy fails? That's certainly one that I've seen. Or just when you know, our CSM is just way out of whack. We need to update it because there's things going on that, you know, are not supported by our understanding. Or maybe it's 5 years, you know, based on something like a 5-year review from a regulatory program. So hopefully no one answers never, although I see a couple of those showing up in the responses. All right, let's go ahead and close this poll. So, you know, we had a lot of different responses down here. Ideally, you want to update the conceptual site model, you know, as you get new data. Now, that doesn't necessarily mean, you know, every time you collect a sample from a well or a soil boring, you have to go write some kind of new report. But you at least want to consider the new data that you've collected and decide whether it fits your conceptual site model or if it kind of goes against what you thought it would show. So like I mentioned before, with this step, you want to consider how to integrate the data from all the phases of a project, and that's something that's certainly site-specific. One thing I want to point out is that as the project progresses, the data needs shift. So at the beginning of a project, maybe when you don't have a very well-developed understanding of your site, you might have a very general data collection objective, something like we're going to define the extent of contamination above MCLs. In the late phase of a project, you might have a much more specific data collection objective. For example, let's say you have identified at your site that there's a silt layer that you know is important in storing contamination at your site, and you're trying to, you know, determine, you know, one, how thick that silt layer is and how much, you know, VOC mass is stored within that layer. So that set of data collection objectives is going to look a lot different than the one I mentioned before, where you're just trying to define the extent of the plume above MCL. So as you get further developed with your CSM, you may have data collection activities driven by specific questions later on. But the point is, overall, you want to continue to update your CSM as you get new data and go through this process. So just to wrap up our dry cleaner case study, this is all the data together, so the soil, the groundwater, and the soil vapor, showing that, you know, while the previous understanding, you know, presented the general idea of where the contamination was, the project team learned a lot more by combining all these data and updating the CSM. So this is the previously understood plume. This is the new plume. And within the source area, sort of answering this final question, the reason that the remedy wasn't really making the progress that was desired is because there was a whole bunch of source material located deeper than it was previously understood. So across this cross-section, sort of simplistically shown here, there was a lot of residual source material shown pretty much across this whole area, and the injection system was only designed to treat what was shown in blue here. All right, so to wrap up the dry cleaner site, I do want to emphasize that this characterization event was just the start of looking at the vapor intrusion pathway here. This led to several follow-on activities, things like residential indoor air evaluation and sampling. There were some mitigation systems put in, I believe, in some of the commercial buildings. So this was just the first step. This was not the only thing done for soil vapor, but this was the start of it. During the data collection itself, the project team, as I mentioned before, was able to look at the data, decide where to go next, and avoid unnecessary data collection. So because of that, they were able to meet the objectives of this characterization program, but actually finish early. So they had a whole additional week of activities that were scheduled, but they determined that they met all the objectives, you know, before the program was scheduled to be over, so they ended up saving money on the actual program itself. All right, so that takes us through the implementation part of the integrated site characterization process. Now I'll turn it back to Alec to wrap us up.
Okay, thank you, Ryan. Let me close out today's course with a brief summary. So you've heard a ton of information from Tamsin and Trevor and Jeremy and Ryan, and now it's our hope that you're going to go and apply ITRC's guidance to the sites that you're managing. Understanding the subsurface behavior of DNAPL is technically challenging, and methods for site characterization have evolved. ITRC's integrated site characterization guidance, it describes an updated understanding of the factors controlling contaminant distribution and behavior of DNAPL at DNAPL sites. And it also includes the tools and the resources that can lead to better, more accurate CSMs. The expected results of using this guidance are more accurate CSMs, reduced uncertainty, and an optimal lead-in to developing an overall integrated site remedial strategy. And that's the subject of ITRC's 2011 guidance. Slide 109. As a reminder, the site characterization guidance is structured in these three modules that are outlined here. And they include planning your site characterization, which includes considering uncertainties, data resolution needs, and your data collection objectives. It also covers guidance on selecting the most optimal data collection tools that are based on your objectives. And it includes best practices for implementing and processing and sharing your data collection results. On slide 110, so we believe that the integrated site characterization guidance is the best path forward. And that's because it does a lot of things, but it, you know, first and foremost, builds trust and confidence in site decisions, particularly in a world where there are too many DNAPL sites that have not achieved regulatory standards in a reasonable time frame. And we saw that showing up in the various polls that we've done during this training. And that was our experience as well. And it's also because heterogeneity is the new normal. And properly characterizing sites, has it critical implications for the remedy selection and the remedy targeting that will help you optimize success. So finally, with that, I just want to thank you for attending. And here's how you can get more information. And please give us your feedback.
Thank you, Alec. At this time, we will have another question and answer session. Remember, you can type your question in the Q&A pod in the corner of your screen. Before we get to the questions, I'm going to pull up a couple poll questions we're hoping you'll fill out for us before you leave us. Also, the Quillen training page will remain active in case you'd like to access it at a later time. We would like to hear feedback from you today, so please make sure that you pull up the feedback form that's linked on this last slide. You can also access the feedback form by clicking Feedback in the Related Link section and then clicking Browse To. As a reminder, filling out the feedback form and certifies that you participated and allows you to receive a certificate of completion. With that, we'll move on to a couple of questions. Our Q&A pod has been busy throughout the session, and our presenters have been going in and replying to people individually. So I thank everybody for participating throughout the session. As a reminder for anyone on the phone that would like to ask a question, it's #6 to unmute. Again, anybody is welcome to use the Q&A pod, and I'll read any new questions out loud during this time. Well, I do want to thank everybody today for your questions, and thanks to our trainers for providing answers throughout the Q&A sessions and throughout the presentation. If you need further clarification on the answers or would like to ask more questions, please feel free to email us at training@itrcweb.org, and we will follow up with our trainers to get your questions answered. Well, you are welcome to follow up with any of our trainers directly. Special thanks to our participants today. We appreciate you taking the time out of your busy schedules to join us. Remember, we do archive our classes, so if you are unable to join our live classes, you are welcome to access our archives. We'll give them one more moment of pause to see if there's any additional questions. All right, again, thank you for everybody's participation. We really appreciate you joining us today. I have pulled up the feedback form. I encourage everybody to please provide responses.